Aloha everyone, this is Larry Camp, and welcome to the Nobody Knows Your Story podcast, which just happens to come with a side of Hawaiiana. Nobody Knows Your Story is a podcast which I believe will impact each listener in a positive way. As you listen to the experiences that have transformed, shaped, and guided each guest, perhaps you'll better understand your own personal journey. Some will surprise, some will make you question, and some will inspire, but all will leave you in a better place for listening in. As for the Hawaiiana, well, that's just a big part of my life story. So I invite you to check in each week and listen to the life experiences of people just like you. Everyone, you just heard a beautiful instrumental by Makana called Deep in an Ancient Hawaiian Forest that was used in the movie The Descendants. Once again, if you enjoy the music that you hear on my podcast, please purchase the music of these artists and don't hesitate to contact me if you have questions or would like a little bit of Hawaiian music information or suggestions. In today's Nobody Knows Your Story episode, you'll be hearing the life story of Lark Dean Galley. She recounts she kind of talks about her early life, which, you know, involved moving many times, living in difficult circumstances, and how these experiences drove her to want life of structure and order. Like many, Lark has had to learn to cope with loss, and we'll talk about her book, Learning to Breathe Again, Choosing to Heal After Losing a Loved One to Suicide. Life's experiences has led her, to look at things differently. She's more reflective and less aggressive, and when it comes to situations that once required promptness and deadlines, she's adopted a belief, I guess, that things will all work out. Now, she's going to talk a little bit about, of course, her son and his passing. And we talked a little bit in advance, and I know that he really liked the song Over the Rainbow by Bretta Iz. So during the podcast, we'll go ahead and insert that song. So, Lark, welcome. Yes. To Nobody Knows Your Story.
Thank you. I appreciate this opportunity to chat with you, Larry.
And I appreciate you on somewhat short notice being able to sit down and take some time and tell us your life story. So I'm excited to hear it. We don't know each other well at all. I mean, we've talked briefly here a few minutes before we started today, but that was kind of our first meeting other than a few back and forth emails.
That's right. And plus, I did listen to your story on your podcast where you got interviewed. And as I was listening to that, there were many times when I identified with what you had been going through with growing up outside Utah, coming to Utah later, and trying to acclimate here with maybe having some difficult struggles, you know, financially as a child. And then just the whole second marriage and losing a child. So there were many things that I felt we connected with.
No, absolutely. And I should say, I just finished reading your book here over the weekend and felt the same way. Just a lot of like, oh, I can relate. Yes. So yeah, a lot in common.
Yes.
Well, go ahead, Lark. Just go ahead and start where you want. And, you know, we're just excited to have you here and just looking forward to hearing your story.
Thank you so much. So you mentioned in the introduction about how I talked about my childhood. And I just wanted to say that when I originally was thinking to write a book about my son's suicide, which was March of 2019, I was not planning to write anything about my childhood. And I have a high school friend that we still are in touch with each other. I don't have many because I moved around every year of my life. She talked to me and said, you know, you need to put in some information about your childhood and how the instability contributed to your life, you know, later on. And I was thinking, what is she talking about? Because when you're in a situation, it's normal. It's, you know, you don't feel like you're different unless you compare it to something. And I didn't have much to compare it to. So I thought moving around every year was normal. I thought not having very many things, you know, we hardly had anything, any furniture, and we hardly had any clothing. We just had very, very few things. Lots of adventure, because we found out when my father was in his 50s that he was bipolar, so undiagnosed that whole time. And my dad always made things feel like it was an adventure. So, but not a lot of things that might create some stability. You know, we had meat once a week, which was on Sunday, and that's the only time we could afford to eat meat. And just some things like that. And so as I was writing out my youth and the instability that I can, as an adult, look back on and say, well, that was kind of crazy times, you know, seven kids in the same bedroom because we couldn't afford to heat the other bedroom, and or there was a house with two bedrooms and that was it. So a lot of just some craziness. And I look back now and I see, as an adult, how I parented and how I structured my life was to create some stability that had come from so much instability as a child. And I say this because I needed structure. I needed things organized and orderly. And my son did not understand that, which was part of the reason we had these conflicts almost every day. You know, son, clean up your stuff, clean up your area. You need to put things away. And it was continual arguing about different jobs, getting things done. And he thought I was OCD, and maybe I am a little bit, but I realized that that's how I had to keep my head organized and not slip into maybe a depression or a little bit of crazy thinking that I had inherited from my father and his mother and my great-grandmother. So.
Sure. Well, and I'm glad you put that, your story, in the beginning of the book, because, you know, I'm a people person. I like finding out what maybe drove this person, or, you know, kind of led this person down this path. And unless you know how they grew up or what their circumstances were, you don't really get the full picture. So I'm glad you put it in.
Thank you. And it was very cathartic for me, and it was eye-opening. It wasn't until I wrote all of this down and I reflected that I realized that's the reason for what I do, the way I do things.
Well, and you were the oldest of seven children.
Yes.
Obviously, being the oldest, you know, you're in a different position. You know, you were the only child for a while. And then, of course, as these children were born to your parents, then you started to, I'm sure, take on additional responsibilities to, if nothing else, just to help out.
Exactly. And, you know, once again, reflecting, I don't know that I was ever really a child for very long. I was doing chores, you know, carrying laundry baskets at five, because Okay, you have to understand the math on this. I was 5 and a half and there were 7 children and I'm the oldest. And how that happened was a pregnancy every year for my mother, not necessarily intentional. And the last pregnancy was identical triplet girls. So when my mother had those triplet girls, she had 4 kids in diaper because the child just ahead of the triplets was only 13 months old. And I really sympathize with her. I only gave birth to 3 children. The last 2 were 13 months apart. And I thought I went crazy with 2 younger kids. I can only imagine having 4 kids in diapers.
Mm-hmm. I can't even imagine it. Since you had those responsibilities, like you say, at 5 and a half, and then you moved around so much, you didn't have those strong friendships that one might have if you grew up and lived in the same house all through, you know, elementary school, junior high school. Do you find yourself ever looking back and maybe wishing that you'd had more of a structured upbringing? I mean, obviously it would have taken you down a different path. Or do we just, like a lot of them, I guess I ask people this question all the time, or do you just say, you know what, hey, I can only go with what I went with and this is all I know?
And, you know, I would say that because it's the only thing I knew. There was a lot of adventure in my life, I will say that. And it made me the person that I am. I'm very outgoing, but my regret is because of my father's bipolar, he was not very emotionally available. And so all of us siblings, we develop this emotional detachment. So it's fairly easy for me to detach emotionally from relationships. And I need to be very careful about that. And so I have a lot of acquaintances, but not a lot of friends. I have very few people that I spend a lot of time with. They're very few. And it's just because of how I grew up. You know, we didn't have a lot of people over. We didn't interact with a lot of other people. And so I have a woman in my neighborhood who, she's been here 7 years now, and she has, you know, been a kind friend to me and would say to me, "Oh, I love you so much, Lark. You're so kind to me. You've been so good, and I really care about you." And it took her about 2 years of saying that to me continually for me to say, "Oh, okay, I think she's serious. I think she really does want to have a relationship on a deeper level where we can connect more than just superficially." And so that's something that I need to work with, is developing deeper relationships.
Well, and you mentioned in your book, you know, the passing of your son, you changed. And, you know, you even used the term, I think you changed on a cellular level.
That's what it felt like. Just because of the grief, I felt every cell in my body changed. And before, I was very structured, very get it done, task oriented. Relationships didn't matter. It was just, you know, what needed to be done, get it done and accomplish that next goal. Somewhat immune to other people, to criticism, or to other people's feelings in some ways. I might be a little bit, you know, very direct about how I would say things, not take a lot of time with other people. And now I have slowed down. I take time to talk with people. For me, the most important thing in my life is sharing this story about change, about my son and my father's suicides, and what can we do to prevent it? So I feel like a completely different person.
And it's hard to go through those types of tragedies and not be a different person. Then you combine it with, we're getting older.
Yes.
and that alone, I think, you know, for me, I'll just speak for myself, has caused me to kind of be more mellow and kind of maybe have more patience than I did when I was younger. But so I don't know how much of that is, you know, due to the loss of my son, that unexpected loss, or just getting older, or both.
Well, I think too, it might have to do with your granddaughter, you know, mm-hmm. because as you get older, and sometimes you can see yourself in your children and in their way they parent, and or the way other younger parents parent, and you think, you know, what you're amping out over really isn't the most important thing. Let's save that craziness, or, you know, that heightened level of intense scrutiny for when there's something serious going on. I've just changed the way I parent. I don't feel like I'm my child's savior. I don't feel like I have to dictate everything that they do. I just don't want to be making all these decisions for them. If they want to do something, I want to create a space that allows them to come to me and be open with how they really feel about something and what they want to do with their lives and not put so many restrictions on them.
Again, and that's, like you say, that's something you feel now that 10 years ago, obviously you felt differently.
Oh, yes.
And that's how I am. And you mentioned my granddaughter. We've had them here since July. Every day I see my daughter interacting with my granddaughter. And I've gone to Judy and I've said, wow, I'm just amazed at how much a little two-year-old requires of your time. Because when my kids were little, I was gone. I was working. I was out of town a lot on business. And I never realized how much work and effort and time Judy put into these children. So I think it's actually given me more of a respect and understanding, appreciation for my own wife. It's kind of odd, but kind of an interesting takeaway from having my daughter and my granddaughter here. So yeah, things change all the time with our lives, no doubt.
Yes. And in many ways, it's been good changes. It's been hard changes, but it has helped me become a better person, a kinder person, one who is willing and able to support other people and just not get so caught up in maybe pursuing that next goal or the next material goal or the next trip or all of those things that society puts a lot of emphasis on.
I think it just puts things more just in perspective, like you say. I mean, it's like, it doesn't mean that things, material things, aren't important or that we don't need them to, you know, survive without income. So we have to do certain things. But on the other hand, maybe it just, like you say, shifts around maybe what was at the top of that importance ladder and maybe brings it down a few rungs.
Exactly. It shifts just the whole priorities, you know, where you're willing to put your time and effort and what becomes of most importance.
I encourage people to obviously buy your book, you know, Learning to Breathe Again, Choosing to Heal After Losing a Loved One to Suicide. I found very interesting, of course, but also I just, like I said, I could relate to many of the things in the book that you talked about, but also just, you know, hearing about Christian and his life and, you know, your upbringing and, you know, your husband's life and your children. I just really enjoyed it. So I think if it's okay, I'd like you to maybe talk a little bit about Christian.
Sure. You know, Christian was a brilliant boy. He was 19. He was in the engineering department at the University of Utah, something he had wanted to do his entire life. When you looked at him, he was not one of these kids where you're like, oh yeah, that kid's destined to, you know, total fail. He's a problem child. That was not Christian. He was well-liked. He had a lot of friends. He was socially active. He had hobbies. He had something to look forward to for a trip he was going on with his dad the next week. All of these things, you know, that we don't attribute to someone who suddenly takes their life. And yet some things happened all at once that kind of compiled and stressed him, and he just decided to be done. The hard part for me is, you know, having to admit that as a parent, I did not have a great relationship with him. He argued with me every day of his life, and it was so frustrating for me as a parent. And I would try to do different things and try to repair a relationship or maybe stay away from him physically so that we didn't have to interact in different things, and nothing seemed to work. And it was only through sharing his story, writing this book and talking about it, that I was able to heal and finally feel very close to my son. I feel closer to him now than I did before he passed away. And I feel that he wants his story shared. He wants other people to know that he regrets taking his life, and that if he were to do things over, that's not what he would have chosen. People who die by suicide, they're not in their right minds. It's not a situation where we condemn them. It's an opportunity to show compassion and love for someone who has overcome this innate barrier that we have as humans for self-preservation. And so something is obviously broken with them mentally that they would consider this, and that they would say, I want to just end this pain, and I don't care how it ends. I just want to end it. And that's what's really hurts me as a parent. I look back, that's a regret that I have, that there was not an open conversation that we could have, that he could tell us how he was really feeling.
Seems like, and I'm just going from memory now, it's not like it's been a long time since I read your book, it was just a few days, but it seems like there was a point, I want to say maybe when he was around 16, that he first was having some of these issues, but then he kind of, you know, kind of overcame them, or so you thought.
Yes.
And isn't that kind of common with folks that are thinking?
That's what I have found out since he passed away. So he was 15, almost 16. He started his sophomore year in high school. He and his dad were having the parental conversation, you know, you need to buckle down, you need to focus. If you want to get into college, you need to do these things. And, you know, that's the hard line as parents. We want to push our kids to do better, but at what point have you pushed them too hard? And my husband was in the military at the time. He'd been trained with the suicide training because, as you know, we lose more vets to suicide than in the wars. And he noticed my son started to disengage from the conversation, to disengage with the eyes. And he had the presence of mind to ask Christian, are you feeling suicidal? And those are key words. Because first of all, we don't always feel comfortable saying that. But second of all, if we say, are you considering hurting yourself? The person who is already hurting is thinking, I'm not going to hurt myself. I'm going to feel better because as soon as I die, I'm done with this pain. And my son admitted, yes, I am. My husband immediately came into the house, said, Christian's feeling suicidal. Go talk to him. I am going to make a phone call to the military suicide hotline and get him in to see a therapist the next day. This was a Sunday evening, so we had to wait till the next day. And I took him into the therapist. She talked to him for about an hour. I was invited into the room, and she said to Christian, do you want to tell her or should I? And he said, no, I'll tell her. And he said, Mom, I don't believe in God. I believe in science. And he looked at me like he was expecting me to be very angry. And I just said, well, son, I believe God is science, but if that's what you believe, you run with it because I can't make you believe anything. And that was a regret that I have, that he didn't feel comfortable having this conversation with me without a third party in the room. And then he continued to go to the therapist for about 2 months. He would see her every week and they would walk through steps of helping him to get better. And it came out that he did have a plan for how to end his life, which for me was shocking. And I have to tell you that even though my father had died by suicide just a couple years prior to this initial situation with my son, I always thought suicide was out there, not in my house. My kids wouldn't do that. They know better. They know that, you know, how tragic it was for me with my father's suicide. They would never choose this. And so, well, I did everything I could to help my son take care of his emotional health. I didn't take him 100% seriously. And that's a huge regret. So after 2 months, he said, Mom, I'm doing good. I don't need to go to the therapist anymore. And I took him at his word. And I never had another conversation with him about his mental health, which is my biggest regret. Because after he passed away, I talked to a therapist and I said, you know, he had these feelings 3.5 years before he actually died, but he seemed to be doing well. And the therapist told me that is so often the case when someone is so depressed and suicidal and suddenly they seem happy again and they're like, we're good to go. Because they have come up with a plan and they know that whenever things get bad enough, they can initiate that plan. And so they're just going to carry on until one day it's too much. And at that point, none of the people around them, their friends or family, can really do anything because they didn't realize that there was a problem. And that is huge. That's very common in suicide cases.
And for Christian, he was 19, and we've learned now that the human brain doesn't fully develop until someone's like 24, 25 years old.
Yes.
So if you look at the things that were going on, and again, I'm recalling, but there were some issues with his grades at school. If they dropped below a certain level, then he was going to have to maybe pay for some of his tuition. There was a few items like that kind of came together all at once.
Right.
There,
a car accident the week before, he was probably going to lose his driver's license, and that was the case. After he passed away, we got a letter, and then he and his father kind of had a talk. You know, one of these other parental talks. It was 11 o'clock at night. He came home from school. my husband, you know, decided that's a great time to have this parenting talk, you know, like, hey, let's look at reality. And I'm in retrospect, I'm like, okay, let's have parenting talks, but let's not do them at the end of the day when everyone is exhausted. That's not the time to have these conversations.
There's no manual for even being a parent. I mean, we're just doing the best we can, you know?
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And you know, I have to say that I really do believe my husband's presence of mind allowed us 3.5 more years with Christian. I believe that, you know, and it would have been even more devastating to lose him so early because we would have had no clue or, you know, it just would have been a lot harder because we hadn't managed to continue to improve our relationship. And for as difficult as my relationship was with my son, towards that last 6 months, it had started to get better. And that's one of the things that I'm so grateful for, that I never stopped trying to love this difficult child for me. He wasn't difficult for anyone else, just for his mom. And always trying to mend that relationship.
Yeah. No, I understand. And a few weeks ago, we did an interview here with Wayne Merrill, and Wayne talked about just the stigma that surrounded suicide 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Yes.
And how his father, well, first of all, his grandfather died from suicide. And then Wayne's father came to him as a teenager and said, son, I would never do that to you because I know what it was like as a teenager to have yes. that happen to me. And then shortly after that conversation, his father did.
You know what happens so often is in these situations is the person who dies by suicide, they feel like they're a burden to their family. And they believe that if they die, their family will be better off. And we know that's not the case, but they don't see it because they're not in their right minds. In their mental state is just not a place where they can function. And that is just hard. You know, with losing my father to suicide 5 years before my son, at that time, the stigma and the thought about suicide, I couldn't even talk about it. My best friends didn't know how my father actually died. I just physically could not talk about it. And then when my son died, I started to go down that hole. And I was in 5 months depression with my father's death. I started to go into that black hole of just not feeling, not coping, not functioning. And I caught myself and I said, I don't have the luxury of mentally disappearing. My family is struggling. And I got some phone calls from a couple of friends who told me about their teenage kids who were struggling and how afraid they were. And within just a couple of days of my son's passing, I had a realization. I felt like I got called on this new life's mission, which was this situation was not about me as a parent. It wasn't about my parenting fails and, oh, I should be embarrassed. It wasn't about my son and his struggles. This was about helping other parents see that they needed to wake up and be aware of this is the number one killer of youth in Utah. It's the number two killer of youth nationwide. And not to be complacent like I was and say, oh, it's out there. Because statistically speaking, it will affect you in some way. If not now, very soon. And if I can save one parent from having to go through what my husband and I have gone through, I will have changed a life. And that is why I get up every day. I do as many podcasts as I can to reach as many people. It's why I wrote the book and just want to share that these are very real concerns. And my biggest concern is if you feel like you don't need to be concerned. That's a big concern.
Like you said, this isn't something that you felt you needed to do. It wasn't a mission that you would have chosen, but it was one that you'd been given.
Exactly. You know, honestly, if you had told me 19 months ago, right before my son died, oh, Lark, you're going to be on my podcast and we're going to talk about suicide prevention and we're going to talk about these, all your details of your personal life and how you grew up and you were kind of messed up, etc. I would have said, no, Larry, we're never going to do that. So, and yet that is what I feel called to do.
And you used the word stigma. I think I did too. But that was Wayne's whole point. Wayne battled depression, but he sought help and he actually got help. And he believes that's why he's here. And he feels like if his father would have sought help, that maybe his father would still, you know, have lived a long life. So we need to, for sure, get rid of that stigma. I mean, depression, mental illness. I have high blood pressure. I take medication for that. Yes. I mean, people don't look down on me or think oddly of me because of that. So we need to look at these things differently. And I think that that's a big part of what, you know, you're saying in your book and what you're saying when you speak to groups and, like you say, on podcasts and so forth. And I'm with you there.
Yes, it's just have compassion. And I would say, especially with this year, crazy year 2020, we are contributing to these situations that create these feelings of isolation and separateness and that lead to these depression and eventual suicides. And early in the year, I think San Francisco therapist reported that attempted suicides was up by 30%. And so we have to be especially cognizant right now because of the pressures that some people feel, you know, the uncertainty of what's going to happen, the fear, the anxiety, all of these things that are going on, they are contributing to the causes that would lead someone to attempt suicide.
Okay, this one's for Gabby. Babies cry and I watch them grow. they'll learn much more than we'll know. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Someday I wish upon a star, wake up where the clouds are far behind. Me, where trouble melts like a lemon drops, high above the chimney top, that's where you find.
How have your daughters dealt with the loss of their brother? And I guess his older brother that came into their lives.
Our little elf story for those, exactly. You know, that was kind of funny. I would say, you know, for the older daughter, she and Christian were not very close. They kind of had this love-hate, mostly hate relationship. And she had felt prompted to be nicer to him just 2 months before he passed away. And she hadn't quite put those promptings into effect. And so she had a lot of regrets about the way she treated him. She spoke to him. She was able to give 2 different speeches at her, the college where she graduated from, to these groups and talk about suicide. And the audiences were very moved and they just felt how important this topic was. So she was able to talk about it a little bit, but she also experienced this radical change where she had a very difficult time getting up and going to her corporate job. And this was a place where she had wanted to be. She was so excited about, you know, being there and growing her career. And to see her struggle to get out of bed and go to work and even function, she was just had a difficult time. She ended up switching careers, totally different career. But she's much happier now. She loves to hike and she'll go sit on a bench up in the mountains and take Christian with her and talk to him up in the mountains. And she says that's where she feels close to him. And the younger daughter, who was 13 months younger than Christian, she and Christian were very close. And she struggled. She could not talk about Christian's death. And if I brought it up, she would leave the room. In the first early months, she eventually joined the army guard, like her father, went off to boot camp and then AIT for 7 months of this year. Now she's come back and she's going to the University of Utah, and she's doing better. You know, she's able to talk a little bit about Christian. She doesn't leave the room if I happen to bring it up, but she hasn't read my book yet either. So I'm hoping that when I do actually have hard copies, which are coming next week, she'll be able to read the book. My husband has not read the book. He hasn't read any of it. He has just taken all of these emotions and he's had to put them in a little box in his heart and just keep it really tightly closed because he was so close to just going into a dark hole. He and Christian were very close. And then I would say with Caleb, with our elf situation, he was able to know Christian for just over a year before Christian passed away, which I feel is a great blessing. And he was able to be, you know, comfort our family and be part of our family. He and his wife have 4 grandkids, which I believe has saved my husband, because when you have little grandkids, little people who think you walk on water, that sort of gives you a reason to get up in the morning.
Everybody handles grief differently. I know you talk a little bit in your book, but I've experienced this as well. I mean, you know, when you have this sudden death like you had and like we experienced, you have a lot of people reaching out to you, and they're there for you. And that happens. And maybe that lasts for a couple of weeks or even a month or two, but then they get back to their lives, which is totally normal. But then we are left to still grieve and to try to, like you say, get up in the mornings, and everybody handles it differently. And there is no right or really wrong way. It's just, we have to allow people the space to be able to, you know, grieve in their own way.
Exactly. Because I don't always know who's going to show up for the day, especially in the beginning. I didn't know if it was going to be a happy day or if it was going to be, I'm a bawling mess day. And you just have to allow whatever emotions are there and say, whatever I'm feeling, it's okay. I need to feel this way. And also I need to allow other people their feelings and not say, let's move on. You know, you've had 6 months of this. Now let's be done. It doesn't work like that. And I actually thought that the more time that passed, the easier it would be. And that was absolutely not the case. Because in the beginning, you know, I'm very task-oriented. I'm just going to do this, this, and this, and we're going to get through this. But about month 4.5, both my husband and I were feeling really heavy, like he's not coming back in the door, and it's not going to change. And so during this time in the summer and fall of 2019, we sort of cocooned. Like, we didn't want to go out to social events or to wedding receptions. We just couldn't put on that happy face and socialize with people. It's not that we didn't want to do it. It's just like we emotionally could not do it. And I remember a good friend of ours was sort of pushing us to go to the theater with them, really pushing hard and thinking, because that's what he thought would help us. And I finally had to say, I appreciate your wanting us to be there, but I cannot commit to showing up. I just can't do it right now. And I had to be honest with him about it, because, you know, he kept pushing. And that's the thing, you know, if somebody's grieving, offer to be there, and you don't necessarily have to say anything. You can just sit with them. And that's probably all that they can take at a certain time. We don't know. We need to allow people to be at whatever place they are.
Yeah. And that place will change with time.
Yes.
But everybody's not on the same path and on the same timeline. So
exactly. You know, another thing is that, you know, as I talk about in my book, this is my life's purpose now, is to talk about suicide prevention, mental wellness, to bring it to have, you know, to say, let's have the conversation. Let's get rid of the stigma. That's not necessarily the case for other people who may have lost a child to suicide. I have a neighbor, and I mentioned her in my book and her situation with her adult. Well, my friend is not out, you know, talking about that and doing the things that I'm doing, but her life mission now is helping to parent the three children that her daughter left behind. And bless her for her mission, because I don't think I could do that mission. And I know that she wouldn't necessarily take on my mission. And so we have different strengths and have different abilities and things that we feel called to do for the situation we're in.
Yeah. And you mentioned, I lost you there audio wise for just a second, but you said you had a neighbor who had an adult daughter, I believe. And she, lost her life. Is that right?
Yes. So the adult daughter died by unintentional overdose. And now my neighbor and friend, her mission is to raise these three children that her daughter left behind. That's sort of her mission, not going out and talking about suicide prevention. But we all have different things that we feel called to do to make a difference in the world.
Well, and I think that's something else, that when we're young and our life, it's ahead of us, we kind of have a certain vision, maybe in a certain, you know, goal or direction we think we're going to go. And sometimes these things that happen along the way, well, it changes our path and our direction and our purpose.
Absolutely. You know, I just look at where I spend my time and the things that I do, and it's just about sharing this mission. And I'm so grateful that I have the ability and the opportunity to do that, to where I can take the time to share this message. And it just means that's the most important thing to me right now.
I remember towards the back of your book, Tribe of Queens, but I can't remember exactly what that was.
So that's something that earlier in 2020, I got involved with Richard Paul Evans, who was kind enough to write the foreword to my book. And that was a group of women that we started, and just to empower them and help them. We started it as a like an in-person training, which quickly got shut down with COVID. So we moved to more of an online virtual membership. And that actually has provided a lot of opportunities for me to talk to these other women, to interact with them, and to create a community where they feel safe in sharing, you know, the things that they have going on in their lives. So that's been very beautiful. I also mentioned on my website, there's a resources page, because so many parents were coming to me and saying, okay, Lark, thank you for sharing the story. I'm having some struggles with my child. Now what? And not being a therapist, doctor, or counselor, I was like, okay, yes, now what? What can I do to help guide them? And there's a link there on my website that talks about Dr. Paul Jenkins, who is a clinical psychologist, and he and I are putting together some courses that talk about, you know, suicide prevention, awareness as parents. What if you do end up going through a loss, you know, the grief, how can you overcome the grief? He has some modules that people can tap into. And the reason I wanted to do something with him is I love the way he talks about parenting, disciplining, loving those children no matter what. And that's the way I now look at parenting, is you just love your children no matter what. No matter what they do, you still show up, you still love them. What they do is not tied to who you are. You know, let's get rid of this idea that, oh, if Johnny does XYZ, what's my neighbor going to think about me? That's a big problem we have as parents. And we need to understand our most important relationship is with that child, more than what other people think about us.
If people want to go to your website, what is your website?
It's larkdeangalley.com.
Okay. And Lark, and then Dean is D-E-A-N.
Yes. And Galley, G-A-L-L-E-Y.
Okay. Yeah. Because you got a lot of, you know, like you say, good things there that people might want to take a look at and check out.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, hey, I appreciate you taking the time today and for, you know, talking about Christian and about your purpose now and how his passing has affected, you know, many lives. And I think that's the thing. You mentioned it. People think, well, life will be easier for everybody if I'm not here. And, you know, it's like throwing that pebble out into the water and seeing that ripple effect. Many, many people were affected by Christian's passing. And he would probably never even have guessed how many lives that he had touched, that he was important to.
Exactly.
And
that's the thing. We never know how many people are looking to us, or just a kind word to someone that you don't even know how much of a difference it can make in their lives. And just let's do the little things, anything that we can do, or anytime we have the opportunity to make a difference, let's take advantage of it.
Well, we certainly need that today. I mean, gosh, we're just in a world where it seems like we're so divided.
Right. And you know what? I'm just at a place where I just feel so much peace. And I just think, you know, all of that stuff that people are getting all wound up, I'm just going to tell you, it just doesn't matter. You know, the answer really is it's love. It's just be kind and love each other.
Amen. Okay. Well, hey, lastly, I know that I talked to you a little bit about Hawaii, and I believe, if I'm remembering, Kauai is your island of choice, right?
No, it was Kauai.
Yeah, Kauai. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yes.
And you've been to Oahu?
Yes. I went there twice. I went to Maui once and Kauai once.
The thing that's great for me is that I have no problem with whatever island somebody chooses, because they choose them for different reasons. But
yes,
Kauai comes out on top a lot because it's just so beautiful, and it's a little bit more slower pace. And, you know, it's just, I think maybe when people think of Hawaii before they've ever gone, they envision something like Kauai.
Yes. You know what? It was the mountains coming up right out of the sea. That's what was so beautiful to me.
Well, hey, Lark, I appreciate it once again. Glad we had you on and to hear your message. And certainly if there's any bit of advice you might give or something you might say to people that really have not had suicide impact them at this point, what might that be?
Well, I would say be aware, know that this is an epidemic, and to have these conversations with your children. Do it with using open-ended questions. So you're not saying, how was your day? And their answer is fine. Because it's not fine. Talk to them. What was the best thing that happened to you today? And what was the worst thing that happened to you today? Because if they can't express the highs and the lows, they're in that middle ground where they have detached and they're trying not to feel anything. And we just need to be more engaged in what are our children interested in and how can we relate to them on according to what they find is important. Not what we think is important, what they think is important.
Well, that's great advice. And certainly that's something that we can all do and we need to do a better job of so we can change these statistics that you mentioned earlier.
Yes.
Okay. Well, thanks again. And hey, everyone, every 2 weeks now, so check back in 2 weeks from today, and we'll have another episode of Nobody Knows Your Story. Lark, I like to close by saying aloha.
Aloha.
Down a little country road not far away, let's talk story. It's where my mama was born, it's where I come from, it's where my daddy fell in love.